Hey, it's Francis. A couple of months ago, I had the opportunity to randomly run into Padma Lakshmi on the street, which is pretty rad. What a life. It actually wasn't so random because we were both heading to a pop-up by this fantastic Sri Lankan chef named Sam Four, who's, you know, lives in Kentucky. But anyway, Padma told me awesome news. She was filming the second season of her show, Taste the Nation. Now, that show was one of my favorite shows of all last year. So to celebrate the great news, we're bringing back the interview I did with her about it. Have a listen. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. If, like many people, you only know Padma Lakshmi as the host of Top Chef, you know, the one who says, please pack your knives and go, then you may think of her basically as, you know, just this glamorous, globe-trotting food critic. And for a dozen years, she's made herself a fixture in food media through that show. But now, she's embarked on a different challenge, a new kind of show for her, and in some ways, for our food media. She's the host of Taste the Nation, a series on Hulu where she travels the United States, you know, ostensibly to dig into burritos and hot pots and kebabs, but really using it as a chance to show us much more about the worlds of the cooks of these foods. She is, and this is where it feels so different, she's a gracious guest, not a swashbuckling adventurer, and the vibe of the show, which is really about sharing and real listening, feels so important in this moment. We talked for an hour about her show, her journey growing up as an immigrant in Queens, how hard it is to compete on Top Chef, and why she's a little embarrassed about one of the books she's written. It was such a pleasure to get to spend time with Padma and her mind. Have a listen. Hey, Padma, it's great to talk with you.
Nice to talk with you too, Francis.
Obviously, you know, you have this new show, Taste the Nation, and one thing I really love about it is that you're not afraid to confront some of the, you know, complexities and pain and difficulty of being in the world and being in our country. And certainly you do it through food, which, you know, I think for some people is a natural way to talk about. For some people, it's like, it seems like a very odd or unwelcome way to talk about it. But the first question I've wanted to ask you since I've been watching the show is about the very first scene of the first episode, right? And it's you saying to a guest in El Paso, you know, you're saying, like, describe this burrito, and the person starts to describe the burrito they've made, and then you have to cut the scene because you can't hear the guest over the sound of the Border Patrol helicopters.
Yeah, yeah.
So clearly you're announcing...
That happened so much.
Yeah, so you're announcing something about this show. What reaction do you hope people will have to your show?
I mean, so far the reaction has been really positive, which is a relief, obviously, because this is my first TV project, you know, since I've started doing Top Chef, which was more than a dozen years ago. And so there was a lot riding on the show for me also because it was created, you know, by me and is totally my vision. So if it sank, I was going to sink. And if it did well, then I was going to do well. I left that in, you know, because I really wanted the show to be truthful, warts and all. Mm-hmm. This was never designed to be a lifestyle show. You know, there are many of those kind of, you know, beautiful shows about food and travel, and there's many people who do a good job at them. And I enjoy those shows too, but I wanted to do a different kind of show. I wanted to place food squarely in the context of the people making it and their lives. And, yeah. You know, the whole time I was in El Paso, we found it really challenging to film because there were those helicopters over our heads constantly. I mean, it was just like a swarm of bees who would never leave the picnic, you know?
But actually, let's talk about some of the beauty. And this is sort of a logistical question, but how much time did you spend with the guests of the show? Because it seemed like everyone was so familiar and open, in some cases really vulnerable to you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really grateful to every single participant of Taste the Nation, because obviously the show is completely centered around them. And without them and their willingness to be open with me, I have no show. And so, you know, it was very important for me to create that safe space for them. I spent like a week in each city. So I would fly in on a Sunday night. We'd start filming on Monday. Sunday night, we'd have production meetings. Maybe I'd go see a couple of places or restaurants or people or whatever. And then we would film through the week. And then I would leave on Friday or Saturday. My crew would stay back to get just B-roll, you know. So we spent about a week in every city. I really wanted the show to be something different. To me, food is a very intimate act of nourishing your fellow human being. It is also something that is loaded with a lot of nostalgia and emotion and history and heritage. But when we see food on TV, even my other show, Top Chef, it's usually from a very clinical, analytical, even, you know, demonstrative point of view, where we show you how to make it. We, you know, really break it down for you. But we often don't get behind the value, the human value of why we eat, you know, beyond sustenance, but even just for basic survival. And those things, those aspects of food are really what drew me to food. I mean, I always loved to cook. Even when I was a child, I was always tinkering in the kitchen. I really never thought it would be a profession for me until, honestly, I was about 30. And so, you know, I kind of fell into this career. And I'm thankful that I've been able to find my own place and my own way in it. But I just wanted very deeply for this show to be about the people who made the food. It is really, the food is just an excuse, Francis. It's just to get me embedded into those communities.
Sure.
You know, I'm really at a loss why those people decided to talk to me. I'm obviously very grateful. I was worried about it. I didn't know where it would go. I didn't know how deep I would be able to go with each and every one of my guests. And, you know, I was also learning on the job. You know, I'm not somebody who does interviews. I mean, I've done them, you know, here and there at, you know, New York Academy of Sciences with Nathan Myhrvold, or, you know, 92nd Street Y, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I've never done it on camera in a major way. So I had to learn very quickly how to be nimble and also pay attention to what my guest really needed to make them feel comfortable. And that's why we often chose places to do those interviews that were very personal and comfortable to the guest, you know, that they were their spaces, which they were very familiar with and could control.
Not like calling them into a studio, which is, you know, what we used to do when we still had studios. And,
right.
You know, and people would be in like a weird space. And so it's a different kind of work to get them comfortable. But, you know, I think what I noticed too in watching it was how active a listener you are with your guests. And I think that's so much of it. It's like people can tell that you're really listening to them. And I think you also share of yourself, you know. What are some of the more, I mean, I'm sure there were so many, but what are some of the most powerful conversations that you had?
I mean, immediately I would say that conversation with Hamid Mosavi of Shamshiri Grill in Westwood, California. He's a very big, burly, strong man. He's not a very verbose man. It was also the first day at work, you know? So it was literally my first day filming. And that interview took a long time. It was a very quiet set. And I, you know, I knew a lot of details of his life, but I didn't know how I was going to be able to get him to talk. He is a man who carries the weight of the world on his shoulders. He has been through a lot. I mean, he even killed a man, but we don't even have time for it because it's not really connected to the subject we're addressing in the show.
Right.
You know, but to see him really talk personally about what he went through as a as a young man, as a teenage boy coming here, to see him, you know, almost die because somebody left a boombox with a bomb in it at his doorstep. Also, all of the discrimination he's been through. And when I say discrimination, I'm not saying, you know, like it's subtle. I'm saying people were throwing rocks. There was paint on the floor. You see it, you know, go home, Iranians, all that stuff. And, you know, to see a man like that open up and you see tears streaming down his face at one point, you know, I was very quickly, I was like, oh, okay. You know, I mean, I wasn't upset that he cried. In a way, it was a sign that he was willing to be vulnerable. But mm-hmm. I knew that I had to handle this with great care, not for the interview or for the film. You know, it's not a live show. We can totally edit it. We can even choose not to use it if we want. But out of respect for him and his life and the gift that he gave me of opening himself up. Sarah Green from the Gullah Geechee episode, who is the one who has the organic farm and runs the school to teach African-American children how to farm and how to eat well and cook and stuff. When we were on that dock, you know, it was like the last thing we shot that day. The sun was setting. It was very hot and muggy. And she and I, you know, it's almost the last question I ask her. And I said, you know, what would you tell young African-American children if they watch this? Because, you know, obviously she's dealing with those children. So I wanted to give her a national platform so that she could teach any African-American child that was watching, not just, you know, the 60 students that she's in contact with. And she says, you have come from greatness and you will leave here from greatness. And it, you know, I just saying it to you now sends chills down my body, because in that one sentence, she has said the thing that every child should hear day in and day out, so that they have confidence, so that they know they're worthy, so they ask the world for what they rightfully deserve as far as opportunity. And in very simple terms, these people in this series are just going about their lives, and they're extraordinary, Francis. Like, you just scratch the surface and everybody has a beautiful, interesting, compelling story. And these are the Americans that built the nation with their bare hands. But for every face you see on my show, there is a multitude. And has been over generations and generations of this country's development and history.
Padma Lakshmi is the host of Taste the Nation on Hulu, and we'll be back with more conversation, including her theory on why Indian and Mexican food are connected to each other. We'll be back in a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're spending the episode with Padma Lakshmi, who has a food travel show on Hulu called Taste the Nation. It's about much more than taste, though. And just before the break, she was telling us about some of the stories her guests shared with her on that show. She told us about a cook and a farmer. You know, these are ordinary people, not famous chefs or food celebrities. But it's about how they make their mark on the generations who follow them. So let's get back into that conversation. I've always been so compelled by that idea you just said, which is like anyone, when you walk down the street, every single person you see, they're an extra in the movie of your life, right? Like that's just the person walking to the train. That's just the person walking out of the bookstore. Like you'll never see them again, whatever. But if you stop and think for a second, that person has a whole life. They have a story of a whole life embedded in them, and they have the story of generations of lives, and in some cases, the burdens of those generations, and in the gifts of those generations also embedded in them. And like that's what it means to be like a person in society to me, right? From the stories of celebrated people to the stories of invisible people, we all have stories. And even more than connecting through food, I think, like, and maybe we'll talk about this, but honestly, like, I've come to the point where maybe I'm getting old and cynical. Like, I question the power of food to unite us, actually, in a lot of ways. But I do think if we could actually learn to recognize that fact, that everyone has a whole life of stories and generations of gifts and burdens embedded in them. Like maybe that helps set us on the path to understanding each other a little bit more.
Food has as much power as you give it, you know, in every sense of that word. It's a vehicle, it's a tool. You know, a knife can be used to cook your family dinner. A knife can be used to open a present at Christmas. A knife can be used to stab and kill someone through the heart. It's just a tool. And right. I used it to my advantage as a tool to get the show made, to, you know, say to people that, you know, I have credibility, I've been on TV, I've published 4 books on food. You know, please let me in. So like those Thai grandmothers, they had no idea who I was. They'd never watched Top Chef, but their children had, or somebody in their family had. And so, you know, they could Google my name and see that, you know, I have a track record in food. So it gave me a little more credibility than just someone they'd never heard of working, you know, for a show they'd never seen. And so that gave me a bit of cachet to just talk to them about the food. But honestly, that was just the Trojan horse, you know? I think the reason why all those people, and they're all different from each other, right? Some are gregarious, some are funny, some are very guarded, some don't even speak English that well, so they need a translator. I think the common thing that they all felt, I hope, is that I truly feel in my deepest of hearts that I'm one of them. I'm not one of those fancy white male chefs you see. You know, if I was a contestant on Top Chef, I would be the first person out. And I'm, you know, with great humility, I say that with self-awareness, because I know what that show is more than anybody else on set. You know what I mean? I'm there, you know, when the lights are turned on and when the lights are turned off every day. And there's no way in hell. That is not my skill. I don't want it to be my skill. I respect it. I admire it. I know the level of execution and experience and precision and talent required to have a fine dining restaurant or to compete seriously on Top Chef. Yeah. You know, but and it's not even about food. I am these people because, you know, I am their daughters. I am their sisters. I came from India. He came from Iran. She came from Thailand. And these are the people that I grew up with. You know, I know that most people are used to see me in magazines or on red carpets, you know, or on the show, very dolled up. And, you know, I live a very rarefied life now. I realize that. I'm not impervious to that. You know, but I grew up in Elmhurst, and I still pass by those graffiti-filled brick buildings every time I go to JFK, you know?
Yeah.
And it's only a handful of miles from that building to where I now live in Soho. But it is a universe away.
Yeah, totally.
But in my heart, I'm still that young girl from Queens. I'm still that girl who feels like I'm on the outside of some invisible glass looking in, you know? I can't explain it. But when you grow up, and I'm sure you understand this in your own life, you know, when you grow up in America, always being told that you are not the norm, and you almost are okay with not getting as much as you see other Caucasian people getting, because you've just been conditioned to be okay with that. And for immigrants, we've also been conditioned not to make waves. You know, keep your head down, work hard, don't complain, don't ask for too much, just speak with your actions and effort. And so, you know, when I'm interviewing Hamid or Saipin Shuthimov, Lotus of Siam, which I think is one of the best restaurants in the country, it's like I'm talking to my mom or an auntie, you know?
Right.
That's how I feel. And that's why I wanted to do the show. I didn't want to do a show where, you know, we were seeing more of the same, because that's not the show I wanted to watch.
Right. Because you had that show already. I want to get into this.
Exactly.
Yeah. I want to get into this. Well, frankly, I want to get up into growing up in Queens, because I actually didn't know you grew up in Queens. I didn't know when I was watching you walk down the streets of Jackson Heights with DJ Reka, who had then learned in the show was a dear friend of yours. I was like, oh my God, she threw the best parties on the planet.
Yeah.
And I used to live in Elmhurst. And I'm like, you grew up in my neighborhood. So I want to talk about that. I want to first bring us back to when you were 4 years old and you came to the United States. Do you have, like, what were your strongest early memories of arriving here? Like, what did you think? Where were you?
I knew I was in New York. You know, I flew alone as an unaccompanied minor, and it's really funny because it was Pan Am, and you know, you could never do this now with a four-year-old, but my grandfather put me on the plane. He had pinned a laminated card on the inside of my jacket and one on the outside of my jacket, which gave my name and my passport number and my mother's name and phone number in America and his in India, you know, sort of like, God, if lost, please return to
Paddington Bear.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And, you know, I think because, I was so young and my mother also, you know, I didn't care. I would have crossed the ocean, you know, swimming if I thought that's how I could get to my mom. But I was so excited. It was just such an adventure for me. And I, you know, my mom bought the cheapest ticket she could find because she didn't have that much money. And so I went from New Delhi to Cairo, from Cairo to Rome, from Rome to London, and from London to America, to New York. So, you know, I remember the airplane. I remember this other unaccompanied girl who is a little bit older than me, and she threw up on the seat. And I remember going, like when we were waiting to change planes in London, she was sitting and she just like turned around and threw up like all down the back of her seat. I remember that. I remember what she was wearing. Like, she had this yellow dress with like panels of brown and blue plaid, you know, it was very Holly Hobby. And I remember my mom picking me up. I remember her having a blanket, like a crocheted blanket, hung over her arm because she knew I would be cold, and she didn't, you know, it was October. I came on Halloween night. And so that was fun. And I remember when we came home, you know, she had all this candy in a platter, which I thought was for me, but it wasn't for me. She, you know, the doorbell kept ringing. She kept opening it and she kept handing my candy out to these kids who were dressed weird and kind of like hopping up and down and screaming something. And, you know, I was kind of miffed that she was giving my candy. I assumed they were beggars or street dancers or performers or something. And then she told me about Halloween and I thought, wow, what a great country. And then I remember, that when we went out to eat, we could only go to places that served rice because I was a vegetarian kid and I didn't want to eat, you know, cheese or meat or anything like that. And so we'd go to Mexican restaurants. There was a restaurant on the Upper East Side called Mañanas, which she would go to. Or we would go to Chinese restaurants and I would ask for Tabasco and soy sauce, which I would mix and season my rice with. I guess you could call that my first recipe I ever made. Yeah. And I would also make these sandwiches with Wonder Bread, ketchup, and cream cheese. You know, because I just was experimenting with the new packaged foods of America. I remember going to the store. I remember I shoplifted gum because I didn't think it was, I thought it was free because it was just out.
Yeah, Halloween,
you know?
Yeah.
In India, everything's behind glass, you know, and the stores are very small and you literally have like one, if maybe two choices of things, especially in the 70s. So those are the things I remember. I remember being so excited, seeing all kinds of faces. I remember my grandfather saying, you know, be careful of those Negroes. I remember that.
Mm.
And I loved my grandfather. He's one of the, you know, he was one of the most intellectual, intelligent, accomplished, well-read people I've ever met. And yet, you know, he, I remember him telling me that. I remember him telling me to watch out for soup because even soup has the melted flesh of animals in it. You know, he's talking about chicken stock or pork stock or lard or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember buying pretzels for 25 cents because that's all I could eat. I remember with my mom buying a hot dog and getting everything on it but the hot dog, so that I would have this bun with sauerkraut and mustard and ketchup and relish, but no dog, because we were a vegetarian.
Right.
I was a vegetarian. And she was too. I didn't start eating meat really until I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm. I was struck by something you said earlier when you went out to eat, and you would go to a Mexican restaurant. This is sort of a goofy question, but is there a Desi, you know, like a South Asian connection to Mexican food?
Yes.
Well, I will ask it because when I was growing up, I grew up in suburban New Jersey, and I had a few, Indian particularly. I don't think I knew other South Asians, but I had a few Indian friends, and they would always tell me like, oh, you know, I went out to dinner with my family and our aunties and uncles and cousins or whatever, and we went to this Mexican restaurant. And like every time I talked to them, like, oh, we went to this Mexican restaurant. And then when I was in college in Ann Arbor, Michigan, there was a restaurant called Shalimar that was an Indian restaurant that also had a Mexican menu. And I was just like, what is going on? Is there a thing? It could just be totally coincidence, but like,
no, it's totally a thing. And I'm happy. I've never gotten this question and I've always wanted to talk about it. So bless you. Thank you. I knew this talk would be good. Listen, there's a very successful restaurant in Chicago called Vermilion, and there was an Indian chef at the head, and it was an Indian restaurant. It was Manith Chauhan, who is a great Indian chef. And Manith was the head chef at Vermilion in Chicago, and I think they opened one on Lexington, but I don't know how well it did or for how long. And it was literally Indian food married with Latin American food. I'll tell you why there's such a great affinity between Mexican food and Indian food. Because the climate is the same, so the ingredients are the same. Cumin, mango, tamarind, chilies, cilantro, all of these things. And, you know, we know very little about Mexican food in this country. We know about Northern Mexican food. And a lot of that Northern Mexican food has been colonized food, either by the Spanish or whatever. And so it's not really even indigenous Mexican food if you really look deeply at it. But I've filmed a lot, and I've also gone a lot for pleasure traveling through Mexico. We've done, you know, a couple of finales at least on Top Chef. And the food of the Yucatan is fantastic. Like, if you go to the market, the farmer's market at Mérida, and I got the chance to do this with Jeremiah Tower, it is so glorious. And there are all these Mexican housewives who are selling these little balls of dark spices that are kind of wet and pressed together, and they're called recados. Ricottos are just curry blends, Mexican style, but they're a little wet because they'll have like garlic or roasted onion or, you know, some kind of paste, maybe from tamarind. And those are used in stews. And, you know, they'll also use pumpkin seed pepitas as powders, as thickening agents.
Yeah.
We use sesame seed as thickening agents, at least in South India. And so, you know, also the cuisine of Oaxaca. You know, I remember I had Diana Kennedy over to my house for Easter once, and, you know, she was just explaining all of the ways that people don't know about Mexican food and how diverse it is. And and it was then that I realized, you know, I love Mexican food too, and I have an affinity for Mexico in general, and I think that's why. And also the spice level. You know, Indians need to be stimulated with heat.
Okay, so the climate similarities make sense, the ingredient similarities make sense, but and obviously these are both huge countries with enormous richness and the diversity of their regional character, and, you know, like Punjabi food is not that similar to you know, food from Goa, for instance, and right. Mexico, like you can totally span. But yeah, there is a sort of climate band and an ingredient ban. But to you anyway, I don't want to make you like be the ambassador for, you know, 2.8 billion people or whatever.
Right.
but for you anyway, was it ever like a form of sort of scratching a kind of homesickness, or was it just, no, it tastes good and it tastes different? You know, what was your connection to it?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we moved out to Los Angeles when I was older, and I went to high school with a ton of Mexican folks. And so I got to know that food through going to a lot of friends' houses and what their parents would cook. I think it just scratches an itch. You know, I think a lot of Indians love Thai food too, for the same reason. Like, if you go to Jaya Thai, you know, in Midtown or in Murray Hill, it's all Indians. It's like the whole, you think you're at Curry Hut or something, because it's just completely filled with Desis. And I think it's because of the spices and the seasoning and the use of chilies. I really do. That and all of these cuisines love for stews.
Mm. That's Padma Lakshmi, host of Taste the Nation and of Top Chef. And we'll be back to talk about parenting bicultural kids and to hear about the food writers she admires most. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and you're listening to The Splendid Table. We're back. We're here with Padma Lakshmi, host of Taste the Nation on Hulu. We've talked about that show and the people she interviewed. We've heard about how she grew up in Queens. And now we join back in as we get into the nuances of the snacks that make you feel like you're at home and the ones that don't. Well, I was just thinking about the moment in the show where you and your friend DJ Rekha are sitting in and talking about chaat, you know, the sort of street food where it's crunchy things and spicy things and yogurt, and saying, you know, I never thought I could get decent chaat here. And Rekha said this really interesting thing. She said, I think that's what it means to be making your home. I just think, you know, that it's funny because to me, like, I remember being a kid and feeling this intense longing, this like intense food longing.
Mm-hmm.
But not just for Chinese food, specifically for the food from Hong Kong. And even though my family's Cantonese, my family's from Hong Kong, and at home we cooked, you know, that style of cuisine. Like, I remember just longing for specific things I could only get in Hong Kong. So for me, it sort of had like an opposite frame, right? Like, for me, I was thinking, like, the pull for me was in some way because this food wasn't home. Like, I always felt my home was here. And what I could do here and what I could get here was my home was here. And the longing I had was for the thing that was not my home. But maybe the difference is because you actually had time growing up in India for a while. And so, like,
yeah, how old were you, Francis, when you came here? Were you born here?
I was born here. Yeah.
Okay. There's three kinds of immigrants. There are immigrants who are born here to parents who came here when they were young or an adult. There are immigrants like me who came here when we were kids. And then there are immigrants like my mother who came here as an adult. And many of them, you know, retain their accent and, you know, always appear somewhat to be fresh off the boat, so to speak, you know, because they're fully formed, right, when they get here. And so for me, you know, when I think of childhood, I immediately think simultaneously about chaat, yogurt rice, yeah, rasam, and pretzels and pizza.
Yeah.
Because pretzels and pizza were the vegetarian options that, you know, I had in New York City, or Wise potato chips, which you could also get for a quarter a bag. You know, or those long, really salt-covered pretzels, you know, the sticks that you could get for 10 cents each out of a jar at some candy stores or bodegas. So I had this very interesting back and forth all my life, where I would spend from September to June in America with my mom. And then the week after school got out, I was on a plane for 3 months, June, July, and August in India. You know, first in North India, because my grandfather was working for the government. And then after he retired, when I was 7 or 8, we, you know, moved down to South India, where, you know, most of his family is. Because also that was, you know, we're South Indian. So mm-hmm. I had this dual identity, and I, you know, somehow occupied this third space, which was neither totally American at all, although I felt very American, because, you know, I'm a product of the American school system.
Sure.
And then I was in India, where people would snicker because they thought my accent was really Americanized. And you know, and a lot of immigrant kids do. We occupy this kind of no man's land of third space, where we are constantly leaning in one direction or another, depending on the people we're presented with or the situation. There's a whole bunch of code switching. And that code switching also has degrees, by the way. You know, it's not just like an on-off button. There's a dimmer switch there. So, you know. And so it wasn't until, you know, I would say about 10 or 11 years ago, that I finally came into my own. And I remember when it was. I remember, you know, I'm a very secular person, but I do go to the Hindu temple in Queens, you know, a handful of times a year. My cousin teases me that I've gotten much more pious since they opened the canteen in the basement, which, by the way, if you ever want to go, I will take you, because they have the best paper dosas on the planet.
I was going to say, great dosas there.
They do. They have excellent doses there. We just couldn't film there because, you know, they don't let cameras in the temple. I mean, they kind of let us outside of the temple in the Indian episode during a particular ceremony, but that was a big exception that we had to, like, really go through a lot of hoops to do. And that's also because it's my temple and I've been going there since I was 6, when it was consecrated. So we have these ties that are comforting, and that's why food is such a great connector. You know, it's not anything beyond our emotional attachment that gives that food power. You know, like if you grew up with Polish sausages, you're going to crave kielbasa, you know? It's just the power that we give it because of our personal connection to it.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned your mother, and how much do you feel like you want or need to give that to your daughter? There's this really, it's sort of a funny scene, but where you're making dosas with her, I believe, right? At home.
Mm-hmm.
And she's talking about, these are good, I like pancakes, and you're trying to get it out of her. Well, do you like pancakes more or do you like dosas more?
Yeah, and I didn't know the answer. I may not have asked the question if I knew the answer, frankly. Yeah.
It's like, don't put it on record, please. But like, do you speak Tamil or Hindi with your daughter? Have you taught her? Do you want to? Like,
I do. She understands Tamil, but she, you know, poor thing, it's not really her fault. She only hears Tamil when I'm speaking or I'm speaking to my family, her family too, right? My mom, my aunts, whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm the oldest of my cousins. And so most of my cousins are like you. They've been born here. So they're basically ABCDs, which are American-born confused daisies. So they're like Oreos, you know, they're brown on the outside, but they're really white on the inside. And so, you know, I relish being able to speak Tamil, but like even reading Tamil is really hard, and I only have a third grade level reading, which is pretty useless because I don't practice. But I also speak Hindi. So there's like a particular patois that all of the people in my family speak, which is a language that's comprised of English, Tamil, Hindi, and, you know, sometimes Malayalam, because though we're Tamilian, we actually are from Kerala, which is a weird thing. So we're all speaking these languages between each other. So poor Krishna sometimes will say something in Hindi thinking she's saying it in Tamil. Like, you know, I want her to get to bed and, you know, to try and show off and be nice to me. She's saying chalo, you know. But chalo is a Hindi word, you know. but it's fine because why would she know that? Like, I don't care if she speaks Hindi or Tamil. I mean, I told her I would get her a puppy if she learned either one well enough to have a conversation. That was the only thing I could think of to bait her. But so far, it's slow going. You know, she's a biracial child, so she's not even, you know, like me in that both her parents are Indian. And she lives in America. So, yeah. You know, she's much more American in a way than she is Indian by virtue of just her environment, never mind anything I do or don't do. You know, and I am very Westernized, but in my home and in my parenting, I'm very Indian. Like, if you come to my house, you know, you'd have to take your shoes off. In the morning, I just very quickly for 2 minutes light incense, and I have a puja cabinet where I keep my deities. And, you know, we only do like one big ceremony or ritual once a year during Diwali, and that's a big blowout and it keeps getting bigger every year. But Krishna gets her culture in many ways. She gets it through the temple, she gets it through the food, she gets it through the clothing. She also gets it through classical vocal, you know, lessons once a week in Sanskrit, in South Indian classical music, which is called Carnatic music. And she's been doing that for 4 years. And she hates every minute of it. But she, I'm not going to lie, it's not like out of some pious need to please her mother or get in touch with her culture. It's because she knows that if she learns those Indian ragas, she will have
it's the puppy.
An advantage over all the white girls who she'll be competing with, you know, for a singing contract, because since Krishna's been 2 years old, she's wanted to be a singer.
Well, it's ambition. Ambition is great. You know, it's interesting that I hear you say this. And I think even how we're talking shows some of the, I don't know how you want to describe it, the dynamics or the shifting or the tensions, the confusion that I think a lot of us immigrants and children immigrants feel. Like, okay, so I think the thesis of your show, right, is that Mexican-American food is American food, and Thai-American food is American food, and Indian-American food is American food. And, you know, it's this big tent idea of what America and American food is and should be considered to be. While we're talking, like, it sounds so much like I'm talking to my own family, where we make distinctions about, like, oh, well, am I really American or am I really Chinese? You know, like, there's still this idea of, even though we are saying and we believe that America is a mixture and it is a multicolored, multi-hued mixture, there's still like this deep-seated embeddedness we have of like, oh, America is still white people.
Sure. I mean, we've been told that in every way imaginable in you know, in every billboard, in every magazine, in every newspaper, in every TV show, in every movie. I mean, of course we think that, because that's what everybody has led us to think and wants us to think, you know, because that is how that majority dominates, you know, and why wouldn't we think that? We've been told that. And, you know, Chinese-American food is probably different than Chinese food. I mean, Chinese food itself is such, you know, a vast country with a lot of regionality, just like Indian food, you know. You can't paint it with just one brush. But I'll give you an example. When my mom came here, there's an Indian dish called upma, which I love. And it's kind of a food that you can make quickly. It's like sautéed vegetables with wheat that's kind of moistened, and the finished product has a consistency kind of like stuffing, okay? But it's made on the stove. When my mom came here, you know, Kalustian's was the only store in Manhattan, and there were stores in Jackson Heights, but my mom didn't have time to always go buy, you know, suji, which is what it's called in Hindi, and rava, which is what it's called in Tamil. You know, she didn't always have the time or money to go all the way over there. So she would make upma with cream of wheat because that's, you know, because that's what she found. here. And then when I went to college, I would make it with couscous because I didn't eat cream of wheat. So there was never a box of cream of wheat. So I would make couscous upma. If you look at Easy Exotic, that's one of the recipes in there. And I talk about that. Now, you know, I make upma with quinoa. So is that authentic? Well, you know what? It's authentic to me. And when you put a spoonful of that in your mouth, it is undeniably the taste of upma. It has the same seasonings. It has the same vegetables. It just, the base is different. It's like using spaghetti instead of, you know, soba, but everything else you put on it is the same. And that's pretty authentic, you know, to me. So the hyphenate food is a little bit different because it evolves and is shaped by the community in which it blossoms. I think that's really cool. I think that should be celebrated. And I also think it's why North American food is the dominating force across the world, just like American pop culture is, or the American economy is the biggest. They're the biggest because they're all encompassing of all the immigrants who brought the best of themselves and their culture here, you know? And it's funny, we're talking about terminology, we're talking about appropriation. Like, you know, I cringe when I look at Easy Exotic. You know, I'm still proud of the recipes in there, but obviously the title makes me a little embarrassed. But the title was really accurate. Like, it was really useful because what I was trying to do is bring these, you know, foods that were quote unquote foreign or exotic to my American readers and telling them that this can be easy. I was trying to make that food more approachable. And that's really what I've spent my career doing, you know. And it's why I wrote the Spice Encyclopedia, because I wanted a book like that to exist. To me, spices are what give a plate of food its character and its personality and its ethnic origins, or, you know, its mixed origins.
Yeah. Spoken like a true Indian.
Let me
get one more question in before we have to go.
Sure.
And because you're talking about books and you know, what you've tried to do to, you know, your voice in the conversation and sort of educating people about cuisines that might be unfamiliar to them. Like, who are some of the people who are doing that right now that you admire the most?
I think Enrique Olvera has done that with his cookbook, Mi Casa, Tu Casa. I think it's a really nice, simple book, which I didn't expect to be so clean and direct, you know? I was really impressed with that book. I met Enrique when I was in Mexico at San Miguel Allende, where I went to his restaurant. And then since then, we've become friendly because he has Cosme here. And so, you know, he's such a highfalutin chef that I did not expect that book to be as good as it was, because frankly, to me, chefs don't always know how to write recipes well for the home kitchen.
Sure.
I think Tony Tipton Martin is a fantastic writer who is finally getting some play because of the current moment. I mean, I've been saying her name almost once a day for the last several weeks because, you know, Jubilee is a fantastic book. I really love that book. Because it gives you history, it gives you context. Context is everything. It's enriching because the foods that we like because they're tied to memories. And so memory only is a short version of history, right? Is a shorter version of history. And so I think if you anchor food and recipes in memory and history, you give that food the respect it deserves. And in doing so, you give the reader the respect they deserve, not just how to make a nice chicken and dumpling dish, but also where it comes from and why it came to be the recipe it is.
Yeah. And that brings me to something that you said almost at the very top of our conversation that I've been thinking about. Because, you know, it's pretty much a cliche in food media where we talk about, oh, the story behind the food. But you said something different that I really appreciate. It's the value behind the food. And I think that's maybe a step into the next phase of how we should all be talking about stuff. So thank you so much, Padma. It's been really, really awesome talking with you.
You're very welcome, Francis.
Padma Lakshmi's show is on Hulu. It's called Taste the Nation. And of course, she's also the host of Top Chef. She's also the author of four books, including her memoir, Love, Loss, and What We Ate. And that is our show for the week. We didn't get to your cooking questions this time, but we will again soon. So keep sending those questions in. Record a voice memo on your phone and email it, contact@splendidtable.org. Or you can call us and leave a voicemail, 1-800-537-5252. Talk to you next week. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and you can find our podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get them. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.